Chapter 19 Civilization's End. Next door to Amsterdam's red light district, the Zeedijk neighborhood had a reputation for jazz and heroin, just like the Tenderloin in San Francisco. Jazz great Chet Baker, who played at the Black Hawk and the Tenderloin in the 1950s, played frequently in Zeedijk. A singer and trumpet player, Baker sat in on bebop sessions in 1950. When he was in the Presidio Army Band. 2 years later, he moved to Los Angeles to play with Charlie Parker and accompanied Jerry Mulligan in his famous pianoless quartet. But his addiction to heroin dragged him down. Baker's music suffered. Police arrested him repeatedly in both the United States and Europe, and he was nearly beaten to death in 1968. Zeedijk's decline mirrored Baker's. By the 1980s, it had become an open drug scene for heroin dealers and users. Neighborhood residents abandoned buildings and squatters took over. There were a lot of houses that were abandoned and really falling apart, recalled a former resident. Nobody wanted to invest in the area. It was the residents themselves who demanded that the neighborhood be cleaned up. In the spring of 1983, they came to a city council meeting and threw at council members little bags of sugar mislabeled heroin, grabbing public attention. And so, in addition to breaking up Zeedijk's open drug scene, the city government also redeveloped it through a public-private venture. Amsterdam is home to some of the world's finest row houses, and is as fussy about architecture as San Francisco. The city redeveloped Zeedijk in a way that preserved and enhanced existing structures, including the original seawall. Today, Zeedijk is viewed as a crown jewel of Amsterdam's revitalization. In San Francisco, progressives have for 50 years suggested that redevelopment must result in evictions and the bulldozing of whole neighborhoods. But that's not what happened in Zeedijk. The city extended rental subsidies to tenants so they would not be driven out as rents rose. One-third of the housing stock is rent-controlled. We could make a higher revenue on our portfolio, but we choose to keep diversity, the housing developer explained. The money is reinvested in new properties and also more affordable housing in the area, unlike some landlords, where it is probably being invested in their holiday villa. The model was so popular that it is now being used in the neighboring red light district. All redevelopment comes at a price. It can result in a change to the demographics of the neighborhood. Critics of Zeedijk's transformation complain of too many tourists, too few jazz clubs, and rising rents for those units that do not receive subsidies. We have people who rent property with us who are also our main critics, said the public housing developer who had a good attitude about it. We believe that only when you are open to criticism can you really make your neighborhood better. But the price of not redeveloping is much higher, the destruction of human dignity and civil society. Redevelopment makes housing more abundant and can reduce the concentration of poverty. It grows the tax base and generates revenue to improve schools and transportation. That's what happened in New York after the closure of open-air drug markets in the Alphabet City area of the Lower East Side, and its subsequent redevelopment. Redevelopment is a chance to make the Tenderloin, the Blade, and Skid Row walkable, livable, and beautiful. I was surprised to find little opposition to redevelopment, and even some enthusiasm. When I asked L.A. street doctor Susan Partovi, "Can we redevelop Skid Row?" she said, "Absolutely, let's make it pretty." Given California's stagnation, we cannot allow our response to the untreated addiction and mental illness crisis to depend upon significantly expanding the overall housing stock. Human dignity and the sanctity of our cities must come before the political agendas of NIMBYs, YIMBYs, and everyone else in between. At the same time, the Tenderloin, Skid Row, and the Blade cannot be the only sites of new housing development. Attempting to make them that would be unfair and impractical. If California ever chooses to return to population growth while reducing the impact of historic injustices, the state will need to build a lot more housing, from apartments and condos downtown to fourplexes and adjacent dwelling units in the suburbs. In exchange for more apartments downtown, Californians could agree to more suburbs on former farmlands. YIMBYs misdescribe how cities add housing. Cities around the world, from Tokyo to Atlanta, become more dense and grow outward at the same time. Some pro-density advocates have pointed to Tokyo as a city that grew its population without taking up more land. But Tokyo's area increased 54% from 1990 to 2010. Its rate of expansion doubled during this time, and it became less dense overall. Housing in suburbs is far cheaper to build than in the cities, which is how cities from Tokyo to Atlanta have been able to keep overall housing prices comparatively low. Many of us who move to the Bay Area and pay dearly to remain do so in part to enjoy California's spectacular natural environments. These public areas should remain off-limits to any kind of development. But allowing for suburbanization of California's ranches and farmlands would still allow for strong protections of California's scenic natural areas like Yosemite, the Redwoods, and oak woodlands and green spaces near cities. The obvious way to do so is by rescinding the regressive tax breaks California and other states give to uneconomic farms and ranches. Over the last several decades, a declining amount of California's land was converted from farming to housing. In 2009, 5 times more of California's land was used for pasture, 17%, and farming, 8%, than for cities and suburbs. People should be free to use their land for uneconomic purposes, but they should not be subsidized by taxpayers, particularly when the land would have far higher value as housing. Some conservatives recognize the need for more housing. I'm not one of those conservatives who rejects the idea that homelessness is a housing problem, said Stephen Ide. Homelessness is a housing problem, at least in part. There's no way to understand how this developed and changed over the last 50, 60 years without thinking about what happened to housing at that time. In particular, at the very lowest end of the housing market. But whether or not housing can be significantly expanded in California, we should redevelop neighborhoods that have been taken over by open-air drug scenes for strictly humanitarian and public order reasons. In this regard, Giedijk serves as both inspiration and warning. When redevelopment finally arrived, it was too late to save Chet Baker. In 1973, police found his body under the second-story window of his hotel room, with cocaine and heroin in his room and his body. He was only 58. The crisis on the streets has led some progressives to recognize the need for building more temporary shelter. We need to do the New York model and create a lot of housing, said Berkeley homeless service provider and advocate Buna Chima. Half the world lives in shanty towns. Come on. That's the part that irritates me the most. How can you be anti-shelter unless you have affordable housing? But the consensus seems to be pretty anti-shelter, I said. You've been talking to heavy-duty advocates, she said. When you talk to service providers like me, we feel very differently because we've seen people fall out of housing first because nobody showed up to check in on them, and they were out of psychiatric meds and came back to the street. Chris Herring, who works closely with Jennifer Friedenbach, said his own thinking had evolved. In 2000, when I started with the National Coalition on Homelessness, and in 2003, when I did my undergrad work, I became really critical of the shelter industrial complex and short-termism, he said. But when you really start doing the ethnographic field research, going between the streets and the shelter, it's very hard to hold this sort of theoretical position that we need to just do housing first and stop talking about shelter. In the last 20 years, all I hear from city officials is housing first, and we're not doing shelter because we need more housing. But now we've got even more homeless on the street and more suffering. Susan Partovi agreed. Interim housing is fine, she said. As long as they're in interim housing, we can be working on their permanent housing. That can take a year or even more. They could die before that happens. Americans not suffering from serious mental illness should have a right to shelter, not to a studio apartment, much less one in one of the most expensive downtown real estate markets in the world. Shelters should be safe, clean, and humane. But they also must be low-cost, basic, and not so nice as to serve as an incentive to homelessness. And better housing should be earned, not given away unconditionally. Would voters support such an agenda? In 2020 and 2021, I conducted two polls of California voters through Google surveys, which surveyed a random and representative sample of the public to find out. In both, I found strong support for the basic principles I have outlined here. More than two-thirds of voters support enforcing laws against using hard drugs and defecating in public, and support using mandatory drug treatment and mental health care as alternatives to jail and prison. The 2020 survey was of 403 California voters. It found that 71% of respondents agreed with the statement, "People who defecate or use hard drugs in public should be arrested and evaluated for mental health and/or drug treatment," and 42% strongly agreed, while just 11% disagreed, 4% strongly. Most voters in 2021 still felt homelessness was the number one problem that required addressing. In January 2021, most respondents agreed that violent crime was increasing, 52%, and that we need more housing, not less, to reduce rents and eviction, 83%. 43% said mental illness and drug addiction were the main causes of homelessness, and 49% agreed with the statement, "We need to break up the open-air drug markets and offer mandatory drug treatment as an alternative to jail." 88% of Democrats and 29% of Republicans agreed. Other public opinion surveys find that California voters support a balanced approach. A 2019 poll found they support a mix of compassionate and no-nonsense actions. A policy described as involuntary commitment of homeless individuals who have severe mental behavioral issues that may be a danger or harm to themselves or others in the community had 89% support. Support for more homeless shelters stood at 86%. And 74% of voters said the state should recriminalize the serial thefts that Proposition 47 in 2014 decriminalized. Over the last 2 years, we have seen a disturbing rise in politically motivated disorder, from the anarchist takeovers of autonomous zones in Seattle, Portland, and Minneapolis, to the storming of the U.S. Capitol by supporters of former President Donald Trump. In each case, elected officials not only failed to respond swiftly and decisively, they contributed to the undermining of law and order. In every case, I felt an anxiety I had never felt before, which was the fear of losing my country. I began to genuinely worry that America could become like one of the undemocratic and unfree nations I have visited over the decades. Disorder and the loss of freedom go hand in hand. Political leaders who fail to maintain order are often replaced by leaders who sacrifice freedom. I wish more Americans could experience life in a closed society to properly appreciate just how special and precious civilization and freedom are. Around the world, I've met people whose loved ones were raped because the police had been kicked out of an area controlled by rebel factions. and I have interviewed journalists gripped with fear that the people at the table next to us were government spies who would take them to prison, or worse, simply for talking with me. Many of the people who enjoy some of the highest levels of prosperity and freedom in human history are also the least grateful and least loyal to the civilization that made it possible. The progressive obsession with changing the names of schools and tearing down statues of people allegedly guilty of genocide in the past comes at a time when our greatest global rival is actually guilty of committing one in the present. In 2021, the U.S. State Department declared China's treatment of its Uyghur Muslim minority genocide. Meanwhile, during the pandemic, China has behaved in increasingly menacing ways toward U.S. allies in the Asia-Pacific region, such as Australia, Japan, South Korea, Taiwan, and the Philippines, and continues to seek to steal from American entrepreneurs and high-tech firms. Today, America is so divided that some progressives are openly proposing that America split apart. This suggestion raises a question similar to the one Viktor Frankl demanded of his depressed clients. Why doesn't America commit suicide? What should America live for? The traditional answer is freedom, but Americans are deeply divided over its meaning. Where progressives are concerned primarily with the freedom of victims, notes Jonathan Haidt, conservatives are concerned primarily with the freedom from constraints. In the United States, liberals are most concerned about the rights of certain vulnerable groups, for example, racial minorities, children, animals, he writes, and they look to government to defend the weak against oppression by the strong. Conservatives, in contrast, hold more traditional ideas of liberty as the right to be left alone, and they often resent liberal programs that use government to infringe on their liberties in order to protect the groups that liberals care most about. In his famous essay, Frederick Turner argued that, to balance the American notion of freedom as self-reliance and rugged individualism, we needed to remind ourselves that the frontier was also a place of solidarity and reciprocity, and that we needed governmental and other shared institutions. Turner reminds us that much of the so-called freedom of the frontier was often not true freedom at all. The West was the meeting point between savagery and civilization. Psychologist Viktor Frankl agreed. Freedom is only part of the story and half of the truth, he wrote. In fact, freedom is in danger of degenerating into mere arbitrariness unless it is lived in terms of responsibleness. The good news, noted Turner, is that the frontier is also characterized by the capacity for perennial rebirth and beginning over again. Today, that starts with valuing freedom as a state of affiliation, not disaffiliation, and of responsibility to, not freedom from, one another as fellow Americans. And we must return to a view of freedom that is universal, and not just for people designated victims. We must affirm equal justice under an enforcement of the law. In the same spirit, we should recommit to Martin Luther King's commandment to judge each other by the content of our character, not by the color of our skin. We are responsible for our behavior, not that of our group, nor that of our ancestors. The arc of the universe does indeed bend toward justice, as King claimed, and we thus dishonor the sacrifices of our forebears when we suggest things are as bad or worse today than before the 1964 Civil Rights Act. We must build upon our shared progress against inequality, not deny its existence. By the spring of 2021, it appeared that a backlash against identity politics, and perhaps even victimology more broadly, was finally underway. Facing widespread criticism and a recall campaign, the San Francisco Unified School District's Board of Directors paused its school renaming initiative, ostensibly so it could focus on reopening the schools. Several well-known and respected scholars, journalists, and activists including Columbia University's John McWhorter, former New York Times columnist Barry Weiss, Harvard's Steven Pinker, Coleman Hughes, and Chris Rufo, announced the creation of a new organization called Foundation Against Intolerance and Racism to push back against racial essentialism and intolerance. And in New York, New Jersey, and Virginia, Asian parents filed lawsuits to fight racial discrimination in high school admissions and defend meritocracy. No serious historian today would rank Harvey Milk's advocacy of requiring people to pick up after their dogs as a particularly important aspect of his legacy. Milk's legacy is normalizing gay, lesbian, bisexual, and transgender relationships by encouraging people to come out of the closet to their friends and families, and helping to kill a ballot initiative that would have fired gay teachers. But historians remind us that some things which appear trivial at first reveal themselves to be of greater importance over time. Milk didn't get elected on a platform of gay rights. It was too narrow even for San Francisco. He was elected to solve a problem of public disorder, of feces where they didn't belong. In the process of solving an issue trivialized as a mere nuisance, Milk went from being the gay candidate to the people's candidate. He transcended the politics of identity to arrive at a politics of community. Behavior matters, particularly in cities. The dog poop law was, fundamentally, an effort to change behavior by changing social norms. Recall that when a reporter expressed skepticism that police would be able to enforce the law, Milk said the law would be enforced through peer pressure. Said Milk, "When a San Franciscan is walking down the street and sees someone breaking the law, you say, 'Hey,' with a smile, 'You broke the law.' And after a while, when enough people do that, the message will be clear." When our manic character, born of the flight from oppression and the adventure of the Wild West frontier, is unbalanced by more sober virtues, lawlessness and disorder result. Great freedom depends on great responsibility. When conservatives say that freedom isn't free and that we should be grateful for our military families and veterans, it sounds to many progressives as it did to me once, as a justification for militarism, and in some cases it may be that. But it also speaks to the recognition of something much more profound and significant, which is that peace requires security, and that security requires responsibility. The Statue of Liberty, noted Frankel, symbolizes something that is at once essential about the United States, but also incomplete. The American frontier closed over a century ago, and the values of the West increasingly define the whole of the United States, as Turner predicted. But we are not living up to our role as leaders, or to our duty to one another as fellow humans and citizens. As such, it is time for us to grow up. That should start in California, the state that most embodies the American frontier spirit and our love of freedom. And in San Francisco, the city that most embodies its ingenuity. And so it is here, perhaps in the bay that connects the city to America, that we should complete the American project and build what Frankel proposed: a statue of responsibility.